hear the whistle blow. I'm looking for a train. When I hear the thunder roll, I know it's gonna rain. Could just be a joke, I'm not calling you a lie. But oh baby, I smell smoke, there's got to be a fire. When I hear talk behind my back, my ears begin to burn. When a black cat crosses my path, oh, my luck is about to turn. It could just be a joke, I'm not calling you a lie. But oh baby, I smell smoke, that's got to be a fire.
Ah, well, that's blues singer and guitarist Kenny Neal with I Smell Smoke. It's a very nice little hint, a lovely musical hint. It's from the album What You Got, released in 2000. Kenny Neal is the son of the famed bluesman and harmonica player Rafool. I think I'm saying it right, Rafool Neal. He was famous for his harmonica playing. Kenny Neal was inducted into the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame in 2011. So we're talking about smelling smoke today. I'm Yatrice Lead, and this is Lead Stories. The Clinton Global Initiative, the jewel in the crown of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, described as an incubator of ideas for tackling major issues and problems all over the world, officially will shut down after its last annual meeting in Manhattan. And that's supposed to happen between September 19th and 21. Hillary Clinton, however, will not be attending. Charles Ortel is back with us, the expert on the Clinton Global Initiative, the Clinton Foundation, and several offshoot pseudo-philanthropic programs, returns to us to explain the significance of the CGI voluntary shutdown and why it may just be a symbolic gesture to keep a massive gathering storm of investigations at bay. And Charles, it's great to have you with us once again.
Thanks for having me on.
And it is a massive gathering storm of investigations. What have you learned since we last talked?
Well, we'll start perhaps with the Clinton Global Initiative. That began, according to its press releases and to some rather sketchy filings, that began in 2005 with a gathering here in New York. And, my hat is off in a certain way to the people who came up with this idea. In New York City, we have every September either the luxury or the punishment of having the UN General Assembly operate in this city, and so our restaurants are clogged, our streets are jammed, and all these world leaders and celebrities and those who like to go to those type of meetings, they're already here. So it was a pretty interesting idea of whoever came up with it to schedule around the same time when all these dignitaries have already flown all the distance they needed to fly, another meeting wherein, on the one hand, you could allow these dignitaries speak if they wanted to, and on the other hand, you could basically charge a toll to people you would select in your sole discretion to attend this meeting. And, there are lots of people, lawyers, business development types, investment types, bankers, who are thrilled to mingle with former leaders and current leaders, because many of those types have multiple projects they'd like to promote or they want to burnish their own image. And it's really a potential business development tool. Now, where it falls flat on its face, and I think the reason it has to get shut down, and I think even shutting it down won't help it, is that there is little charitable intent here. There's certainly no charitable intent that was authorized in advance by the IRS. I mean, the application to create this charity back in December 23rd, 1997 is crystal clear. Most people looking at this are ignoring the reference to a federal statute which defines what a presidential library is supposed to be. And it's supposed to primarily be, it's crystal clear in the statute, this was to be a presidential library based in Little Rock and a related research facility concentrating upon the historical period in America when Bill Clinton was our president for two terms. That's what this was supposed to do. Yes, in theory, one could have imagined meetings in Little Rock of scholars to think about that, but a meeting in New York City in another state convened to get people, in theory, to get behind closed doors. Remember, it's not open to the public at large, but only at the whim of those running the Clinton Foundation, to sit around and talk about what they might do in the future to help the charity is certainly not a charitable purpose. We have to remember that, you know, I disagree with Warren Buffett on many things, but he did make a very good point, and that is that there are a lot of well-established charities inside this country and around the world already trying to do good. And, you know, the notion that they need a lot of help coming up with ideas, I think, is laughable. I mean, most charities, when you talk to them, will say they have a surplus of money, and they have difficulty finding worthwhile projects. To hear what this meeting was supposed to be was a meeting where people would get in this room and then brag, or at least let's just say talk, about what they said they might do in the future. There's no strict agenda. The first meeting, I think, or one of the early meetings, I noticed as I was just checking the Bill Gates Foundation contributions, that the topics that were supposed to be contemplated at either, I guess it was the second meeting, were included religion. Now, you know, it's a stretch, I would argue, for the Clinton people to be talking about how well qualified they are to discuss religion, given the history of this mess. So the idea of pulling these people all together into a room, talking about projects they might happen in the future, not really even to fundraise for specific projects that have been authorized in advance, I don't think that's charitable. I don't think that meets the test that is set forth very clearly in the federal statute and then all of that you can read about if you want to read textbooks about the subject. And indeed, a very similar gathering called Renaissance Weekend that has been around for a long time and it operates in the Hilton Head, South Carolina area between Christmas and New Year's every year. That Renaissance Weekend operation is specifically not a charity. And I know this because I contacted them and I have an email from them wherein they flatly explain that it is not a charity because it is not charitable to go to some fancy party, charge a high admission fee, which I think is on the order of $20,000 per year, and more if you want to, you know, feature your firm on the dais or in promotional materials. It's not a charity to limit attendance to people in your sole control and then to just gab. I mean, that's not a charity. And, you know, even the Clinton team itself, writing in about 2007, Ira Magaziner, was extensively quoted in an article that basically makes my case. It said the title of the article, and I think it was the Atlantic magazine, was "This is not charity." It can't be more clear than that. And so anyway, they've been doing this for a while. Ordinarily, when you engage in activities that are more than insubstantial, there's a legal test of what that means, but it's tiny, that are not in furtherance of your tax-exempt purpose, normally when you do that, you are severely punished by the IRS. So, you know, I think by agreeing to shut this thing down, there is certainly a limit. They're certainly making a case that something isn't crooked. Then the question is, relative to the size of their authorized activities, how material was this Clinton Global Initiative? And another thing to point out is that when you get out of a purpose or you liquidate, ordinarily the IRS forces you to write a very detailed report that explains precisely how you liquidate and how you transfer remaining assets and liabilities or what basis, et cetera, et cetera. I've never done that properly. Never.
Well, this decision to shut down the CGI, the Clinton Global Initiative, comes in the middle of a huge problem for the Clintons and for these various charities operating under the Clinton Foundation's aegis. And couldn't one see that this shutting down was pretty much a concession with the anticipation that if they didn't, then the government, the IRS, or whichever part of the government will proceed with vigorous prosecutions here and a ramped up investigation. And they said, look, rather than go through all of that, let's just shut this down. But is it going to shift what it used to do under the CGI, the Clinton Global Initiative, to some other part of the foundation?
Well, you see, this is the essential problem, Beatrice. You know, there are more than 1 million charities in the United States alone, and the IRS, in theory, regulates these charities. And the most important way in which they regulate a charity is to check and make sure that the charity follows and furthers its authorized tax-exempt purposes. The second you give license to a charity to do whatever it wants when it wakes up in the morning, you've lost the ability to regulate it, and that's crystal clear. That's why you need to have trustees that are truly independent and can stand up to a founder, and obviously they don't have that here. And that's why you also need to have an audit, an independent firm of serious account, those that are not conflicted or not trying to get some benefit out of the Clinton machine. Needs to come in, and ordinarily you get two teams for a big charity. You get one team to fill out the tax forms and a different team to fill out the what is called the audit, the actual income statement, balance sheet, cash flow statement, and footnotes. Two separate teams check all that, and if you're operating internationally, you can have multiple accounting firms work on a project like this, often with lawyers. They've never done any of this. So the simple answer is no outsider really knows what this foundation has actually ever done since it was formed on October 23, 1997. Now, the reason this is very different and the reason I kind of decided to focus upon it when I saw it was a gigantic case study in charity fraud, I initially thought, well, how would I ever prove it? It's difficult. But then I learned that the ways in which you discipline charities are very different than the ways in which you discipline public corruption. In public corruption, the prosecutor has to find the evidence, has to tie it all together, often has to prove intent, and you're fighting a team which is legendary in hiding information, destroying files, manipulating files, you know, manipulating the media, which is seems to be so gullible. In a charity fraud, you don't have to do that. The second the IRS pulls a switch, or any state attorney general or any foreign government pulls a switch and says, you know, we suspect there's something bad going on here, the burden of proof switches. It's not the prosecutor that has to prove the crime. The charity has to prove that it was acting lawfully. And heaven help the Clinton Foundation if they have already destroyed records relative to the charity, because if they destroy them, there's no way they can prove that they haven't committed these crimes. And ordinarily, the trustees and those in a position to exercise significant influence over the foundation would be severely punished, both criminally and probably with civil lawsuits. So you're in a zone here where, just as a guess, what Team Clinton is doing is they're fighting with any outside advisors to limit the scope of their inquiry so that those outside advisors can't discern what I and others have seen through the public record after months of work. So they're trying to get uninformed professional advisors, give them the opinions they need, to delay this as long as possible so they can continue using the foundation and its various tentacles to raise money. I understand that, I think it's this Friday night, but I may have the date wrong, that there's going to be some big party for Bill Clinton's 70th birthday. Now, you ask yourself, why is that a charitable purpose? I don't think it is, actually. But nonetheless, there's a money-raising exercise going on as we speak. These type of presidential campaigns burn money, and so the Clintons need money. I don't think you're going to see them dip into their own pockets here very much. And so they want to make sure that this thing, indeed, I think one of the campaign advisors even more or less made the point that they have to keep the foundation running until the election. Well, I don't understand that at all. I think the reverse is the case. I think that every minute, every second that the trustees of this foundation allow the Clintons to do what they've been doing compounds the massive legal liability that will bite here, criminally and civilly, unless a few things happen. In order for it not to bite, it is possible that whether Hillary Clinton wins or not, that President Obama could pardon those of the Clinton entourage that he decides to pardon at any time up through noon on the 20th of January 2017. And he could, as Bill Clinton demonstrated in 2001, you can pardon anybody you want as president. And, history will judge you after the fact, but you'll get the pardon done. So the first question is, if they are thinking along those tracks, who gets the pardon? Does every individual at every accounting and law firm and, inside this country and potentially around the world, do they get a pardon? Does every executive? If not, who doesn't get a pardon? And that only solves part of your problem because, yes, there are federal crimes committed here, in my view, but there are even more serious and plentiful state and foreign crimes over which the president has no authority to pardon. So they, as a guess, the Clintons are playing a game. They cannot wake up in the morning believing that Hillary will lose, so they're assuming she's going to win. One way or another, if she wins, the hope on the part of the Clintons is we'll just, take out the new supercharged version of Clinton machine magic, make this problem go away.
Speaking of which, the New York Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, has launched an investigation into the Trump Foundation, saying that there's great reason to believe that funny things happened there. I wonder how it is that, especially the timing, how it is that the state attorney general in New York could see rationales for intervening and beginning launching an investigation, and it's really not that much money. And then we have an enterprise that, in your judgment, has been responsible for at least $100 billion. And the state attorney general can't find reason to begin a probe of that.
I actually think that this was a boneheaded move on the part of the Attorney General Schneiderman, because I think now he has put himself and the Attorney General of New York office and the Charity Bureau in a place where they absolutely have to investigate the Clinton Foundation. Absolutely. I mean, indeed, what they really should do is they should forthwith stop the Clinton Foundation from raising a nickel one on the internet, telephone, mail, any other way, in person. They should stop the fundraising immediately. And the fact that Schneiderman is not doing that, in my view, is a gross dereliction of duty that should, in fact, be investigated. I don't know who sits on top of the Attorney General of New York, but it is a gross dereliction of duty to do what he's done. I would go as far as to say that actually, around the country, every state attorney general that regulates charities, should immediately require the Clinton Foundation to cease fundraising within the confines of each state and every foreign jurisdiction, the same thing, until they produce a legally compliant audit from day one, October 23, 1997, to the present. They've never done that. And so for Schneiderman, I have not studied the Trump situation the way I have been studying the Clinton Foundation, not out of partisan issues, but rather because the Trump Foundation, the Trump situation with Trump University is as you say, Eutrice, it's tiny. You know, it's, I mean, it's not minuscule, but it's compared to $100 billion, $40 million or whatever the number is nothing. And the Trump University is actually not as complex. Moreover, it's not fundraising right now. They stopped that thing. They shut the thing down, I want to say, in 2010. So it's not a clear and present danger to anyone at the moment. Now, is it something that needs to be looked at? I suppose it is, based on the known facts. But it, where does it fall on the hierarchy of things that might be prosecuted? I think it falls very, very, very far down the list. And then you have to ask yourself, who made this decision? Did Schneiderman himself make this decision, which I would guess is a little bit unusual? I think these types of decisions get made by staff people ordinarily. Maybe in a special case, the attorney general weighs in and says, all right, you know, go for this one over that one. But, you know, how was the decision made? When was it made? I have requested already that the attorney general in New York take a hard look at certain things. They don't even answer my emails.
And the attorney general happens to have endorsed Hillary Clinton. The governor of the state is a Hillary Clinton endorser as well. So it is not likely that Governor Cuomo will countermand this decision, although it is so blatantly wrong. We have a high-level official responsible for upholding the law, knowledgeable of something that should be investigated, and declaring that he just won't do it, but instead is clearly partisan in his decision to pursue the problem at the Trump Foundation, but leaving the Clintons entirely alone. This is very, very serious.
I agree. I mean, another thing that's come up since the last time you and I were on air together, Eutrice, is that in the press there are reports now that this entity called Teneo Holdings, which is a sort of an advisory firm, investment firm that's created by former close associates of the Clintons, that it might go public. Much as this laureate that we've talked about is also actually trying to go public now. Those are two examples, Teneo and Laureate, in my view, where substantial private gain has been created in association with the Clinton Foundation and its various tentacles. That is strictly forbidden. The tax forms for the Clinton Foundation, federal, state, foreign, still, to this day, do not adequately disclose the many interrelationships with Teneo, with Laureate. The payments to the Clintons personally and to their associates by these various firms are not disclosed as they should be. And, you know, the amounts we're talking about here, the paper reports today, and papers are often wrong, that Teneo may go public at a valuation of $1 billion. $1 billion. Now, you tell me how many of the business transactions that Teneo did had no involvement whatsoever with the Clintons. You just tell me how many of those, and I'll tell you you're probably wrong.
Well, you're a Wall Street guy. That's where you come from. That's your milieu. What is the deal with Teneo, and what is the link with Teneo? We talked about Laureate, which is an international private education entity that for almost $17 million was able to snag Bill Clinton as an honorary chancellor. And this is at a time that Laureate was hoping to raise funds to go even bigger in the private education business, concentrating largely in the so-called developing world, unquote. What is Teneo and what is the connection with the Clintons?
All right, well, Teneo, I think, is the brainchild of the Doug Band, was a very close, he was the body man originally when he was young, with President Clinton in the final, I think, year or so, or year or two of his second term. And then he, according to press accounts, turned down the opportunity to go work on Wall Street for Goldman Sachs to instead become the architect and implementer of Bill Clinton's post-presidency. That's the high-sounding way in which it's described, and you know, the alternative way is he was basically in charge of his contact list and monetized Bill Clinton's contacts over many years, you know, getting him into deals with Ron Burkle and other people. And along the way, Doug, I think, is credited, along with Declan Kelly, who is currently, I believe, they're both pretty senior in Teneo, with coming up with this idea of the Clinton Global Initiative. And it's unclear exactly when Teneo started. I have found records in New York State suggesting that a similarly sounding entity got its start November 16th, 2008. But other claims suggest that it wasn't until 2011. If Teneo does indeed go public and file papers with the SEC, they're required to disclose granular information about their origins, their history, their contacts, et cetera. So I suppose we'll get to see what they claim, and then we can contrast what they claim with what other records show inside and outside this country. But basically, Teneo was... is, it would seem, if you read their website and, you know, get through the advertising and marketing sales talk, it's an advisory firm and an investment firm in a world crowded with advisory firms and investment firms. And, you know, that world is a world I came out of long ago. I mean, it's been many, many years since I've actively worked in it. But even now, I think conditions are similar as they were when I was active in it, and that is that choice business, you know, opportunities to sell companies that are readily marketable to potential acquirers. These type of projects, you know, people fight for them. You're not just given a plum assignment because people like you. And every piece of business, there's a scrum to get. And these amorphous consulting contracts where you're going to hold somebody's navel and talk about the world and, you know, consider alternative ways in which you might reshape a multinational company are not assignments typically where you get paid tremendous sums of money. Instead, oftentimes, that kind of work is missionary work that you do for free in order to get the transactions that spring from it. So the kind of disclosures I think that, you know, Teneo owes us is a real transaction list, not of transactions put together by senior guys at Teneo and women at Teneo in prior lives. How many deals has Teneo done as Teneo and its various tentacles? And how much were they paid for these deals? How does that contrast with, you know, the range of market prices that are assessed for buying and selling and restructuring transactions? And then as far as their investment record is concerned, you know, if they have one, investment by investment, as Blackstone does, as KKR, Colbert Kravis does, as some of these other, as Apollo does, give us a real audited track record of your investment record. How many deals have you done? How much equity did you put in yourselves? Where did you source it? How are you valuing the unrealized investments that you're not out of yet? And how does this stack up against the Blackstone, against the KKR, in you know, very granular fashion? After all, you know, the finance advisory investment world, that's what we do for a living. You know, you should be able to demonstrate, you know, why your track record is exemplary, and then how do you take business away from the established competitors, be they Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley or Blackstone and Evercore or KKR? How do you win business? What are your competitive advantages? What are your deficiencies? And why does it make sense to put any money in here? So, I mean, a lot of questions about this Teneo. The notion that something would come from nowhere and be worth $1 billion today is questionable. And then you have the issue of how much of this business comes out of relationships architected by the Clinton machine. Now, we have, full disclosure, Daniel Halper is an acquaintance of mine who wrote a book called Clinton Inc., and I have read that book carefully. I interviewed him on a radio show once, and he asked me to be in his movie, which is, I think, coming out any moment now. There's a section in that book, several pages of the book, which talk about Teneo and quote, perhaps inaccurately, but nonetheless quote, an employee of Teneo of not really understanding what the heck the firm actually does. This is somebody talking from the inside. And maybe that person was just at the very bottom of the employee pile and, you know, was lucky to hold his job down. But I find the whole Teneo thing to be very odd. I find the decision to invest in it, I've written about this, investment in BC Partners. You Google that, you buy BC Partners. I think you'll find an article I wrote back in 2015. Investment funds, large investment funds, that break from their authorized mission, break from the roadmap that made them great, very frequently stumble. And astute investors, professional investors that invest in multiple funds and have done so for a long time, they look for warning signs. And one warning sign is when you go off mission. BC Partners, I think, used to be called Baring Capital. I don't think it had anything to do with the problems that, you know, broke up Baring Brothers Bank. It is a first-tier investment firm. It's been operating for a long time with tons of money. And their focus, according to their own website, which I checked carefully, was to invest in established, gigantic, multinational companies in which they held controlling positions, i.e. more than 51% of the vote. In Teneo, they went radically off mission. Teneo, at the time they invested, was just starting out. They purchased less than a controlling stake, which is a big difference. It's not like black versus white. I mean, it's just massive. It's like deciding to go, you know, skiing in the ocean, wearing a snowsuit. I mean, it just, you don't do that. I mean, if you're a majority player, you're used to basically being in a position where if you want to change something, you can do it. If you're a minority investor in a private company, particularly a complex one where there are, you know, founders who may be deemed key people, it is a very risky thing to do, to put minority money in. Very, very risky. And, I have and have publicly voiced concerns about why exactly did BC Partners put the money in prior to Hillary Clinton's announcing, I believe, her run. What was the theory here? And what advantage did they see? What were the marketing materials, which clearly exist, that Teneo used to sell the idea to BC Partners? What did those marketing materials state? For all of the different investors in BC Partners funds that put money, you know, through BC Partners into Teneo, what were they told? What do the quarterly reports of BC Partners say and the annual reports of BC Partners, which are only available to their sophisticated investors? What do they tell us about the edge that BC Partners thought Teneo had back when it put its money in? And now what are the marketing materials that are being disseminated around the world concerning maybe taking this thing public? What do they show? And, you know, based on what I've been able to see looking at other parts of this empire, it would seem that one distinctive, in quotes, competence or edge is, you know, a strategic links to the Clinton machine. And by definition, that's just disallowed for a charity. I mean, if the Clinton organization were like the Trump organization, exclusively for profit, there actually would be little wrong with this. But because the Clinton Foundation is a public charity continually soliciting, I would argue using materials that are false and materially misleading, but nonetheless soliciting, you're not allowed to do this. If Bill had wanted to, and Hillary had wanted to set something up after he left where he was going to, you know, create a Teneo or create something like that, he could have done that. And nothing would have stopped them from trying to do that, and Doug Band. Instead, they created charity. Well, you better read the rules.
So this is the question I was going to ask. You answered it. But it still raises some very troubling issues about the relationship between the nonprofit sector, this philanthropic entity, and we don't know quite which of the sub-entities also might have been involved, and the enabling of a company to make massive amounts of profit by going public. This is a very strange kind of an arrangement. How does it escape the eyes of the regulators on Wall Street?
Well, I think it escapes the eyes of the regulators because the primary regulator here is the IRS. And we have a situation with our own IRS, where it's been politicized, been unionized, it's been politicized, And it is alleged that it, you know, viciously and savagely went after people in the right wing, the conservative area. And it would appear with this charity, it's just a, given it a complete get-out-of-jail-free card. We're not even going to do anything here. And, you know, that's just wrong. Whatever side of the spectrum you're on, the second you embrace the notion that the IRS or the Department of Justice can ignore the law and suddenly just, you know, prosecute enemies and reward friends by not prosecuting them or letting them off lightly, you're in a very dangerous place. I mean, the one thing that there are several things that make this country truly exceptional. One of them is that justice is supposed to be applied blindly, without fear or favor, whether you're rich or poor. You're not wrong because you're poor, or correct because you're rich. You know, you're not wrong because you're a Republican, or correct because you're a Democrat. I mean, just this is very, very dangerous set of principles here, and I would have thought. You know, particularly those who operate in the not-for-profit world who do understand, and many of the people I talk to in the not-for-profit world scrupulously follow the rules. They take them really seriously. They understand that charity is essentially an act of giving. It should be selfless. You know, you're not giving stuff away to get something in a charity. You're actually trying to help people, and you really want to make it work. And there's so many people I know, and you know, Yatrice, your listeners know. They really think hard about it. They take it seriously. They have a moral compass. You know, they get the fact that, you know, there are people who need help and may be shy about asking for it. And they don't want to just see problems fester and fester and get worse and worse. They truly want to help. And that's a great activity. And it's wonderful that people, so many people, millions and millions of people in America, reach not primarily into their pocketbooks, but, you know, with the scarcest asset we have, our remaining time on this planet, they decide to really devote themselves. Some people working, you know, as hard in their not-for-profit activities as they do in their day job working in the for-profit area. And that's just to be encouraged and commended and rewarded. And, you know, many of the people we all know who are involved in this, they don't want recognition for it. You know, they see this, they look at this and they say, this isn't about the giver. This is about helping the truly needy. And here, you know, for Bill Clinton, as he to joke about the fact, as he did, I think it was last week or earlier this week, he was joking about the fact that he saw himself as Robin Hood. Well, he may have surrounded himself with a merry band of thieves, but he's certainly no Robin Hood. He's Robin Hood in reverse.
He's kind of Robin the Hood, actually.
So. Yeah, right, exactly. Robin the Hood and Robin the Burbs, too.
We'll take a break shortly, and you can ask your questions of Charles Ortel at 888-874-4888. It's the kind of subject that we can't do all at once because it's so complicated. But I want to assure you that listeners of this program are having an extraordinarily privileged view, because our guide is a person who actually did this before, looking at General Electric, General Motors, AIG, and sounding the alarm that eventually led to the crash, the Wall Street crash in 2007-2008, and prevailed. You were raising the alarm back then. People thought that, you know, this guy's kind of off center. But in the end, everything you said was absolutely correct. And you're saying now that the Clinton Foundation is a criminal enterprise. In fact, you have said called it the largest unprosecuted charity fraud in U.S. history. And when we're talking about $100 billion, and we'll be in ensuing programs talking about the different aspects of how they put this intricate machine together, this money-making machine together, we will see why it is important to subject the Clintons and their foundation to very intense scrutiny, because this is really not right. And we will see the other dimensions, the human tragedies attached to many of these so-called initiatives that literally imperiled people's lives. So maybe we should just start taking questions right away rather than go to a break. Jay from Queens, you're on the air with Charles Ortel.
Wow, thank you, Yatrice. And good afternoon, Mr. Ortel, as well. I was terribly intrigued by the Newsweek article about the Trump Organization, and I found some of the questions that were being asked, or at least mentioned about concerns about his foundation, so much paralleling the types of concerns and questions that you raised, Mr. Ortel, in your review, and you haven't given answers to at least some of them, but basically that the web of the organization structure, and if I may, what they were talking about in the Newsweek article, they seem to parse between the difference of the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton-Hillary and their daughter Foundation very distinctly. If you read the article or not, please let me know if you have, but I thought that they were really touching going as if to say, this is a separate thing. It's already been audited and an ongoing audit. You mentioned the law firm and the accounting firm previously in your conversations before here on PRN. But I thought that they were walking a very fine tightrope. And yes, it showed from my perspective, from what Snyderman is doing, our attorney general here in New York, in his efforts to look at the foundation, Trump Foundation. And yet, from what you divulged in a prior conversation, he totally dismissed the need to disclose the Clinton Foundation's contributors as not, you know, necessary, showed a definite bias. And I want to see both of them prosecuted to the full extent of the law, but I think you can't do it one and do the other. So it just, in many ways, please address the question whether or not you've seen that article or read it. And then the question that they posed, that Clinton, there has been an audit of the foundation, which I couldn't discern which one they're talking about, because you even said since 1997 to the present, there's not been an audit. So could you please answer those two questions that I have, and then I'd like to say one more comment, please.
Okay, I'll try to remember your question. I'm not sure which article you speak of, but let me try to answer the question. There are many, many Clinton Foundation. There's two camps that I would put them in. There's the Clinton Family Foundation. And that is really a tax management foundation, I think. That's an entity that's mm-hmm. created. It's a small thing. And that's one where basically the Clintons contribute money to their own controlled family foundation and turn around and give that money to charities that they like. And that's separate and apart from what I'm focused upon here. Although I have looked at their Clinton Family Foundation, and I would note that they get their forms filed on time. And it's a much smaller operation, but they would appear in that operation to be able to get their audits and forms filled on time and completely. With regard to the main foundation, the one that has declared revenues of $2 billion, total operations could be as much as $100 billion. That's a complete mess. And, you know, people who are not familiar with what a real audit looks like, the way to think about it is if you have an account come into a portion of, let's say you have a six-room apartment, and you have an account come in and take a look at the kitchen table, and he tells you it's a kitchen table. That is an accounting review. If you ask mm-hmm. the account to tell you the status of your whole apartment from the outside of the wall to the interior, you know, to the floorboards, to the ceiling, to the roof, all walls, all furniture, all possessions, that's more what's called a consolidated set of financial accounts. The Clinton Foundation has never procured an audit of its consolidated worldwide financial operations done consistently year to year and in accordance with what are called AICPA guidelines, American Institute of Certified Public Accounts. They've never done that, and you're required under New York law to do that. So that's one thing. On the question of the Snyderman, the law that he's not for the moment saying he's going to enforce, he will reverse track on that. This is a law that requires, it was promulgated, I want to say, by 2004 or so, And it's a law that here in New York State asks foundations to comply with tougher standards than the IRS requires. There is a concern, a big concern that educated lawmakers have, that foreign governments might use public charities to support political candidates. And that's against the law. So there's also a concern that government entities might dispense monies to charity, and that charity might not manage the money properly. So for a range of concerns, New York State, wisely in my view, instituted a special law which said that you have to reconcile the IRS line on your income statement that says government grants. You have to give New York State a detailed breakdown. Every government, every grant, the address of every government agency giving money. And the Clintons have never done that properly. Indeed, the disclosures they make do not reconcile with other disclosures that are in the public domain. It is not a 2-alarm fire or a 5-alarm fire or a 7-alarm fire. It's a 40-alarm fire, because you can look, and governments are starting to ask. The government of Australia is looking at this. The government of Norway is starting to look at that. Other governments are starting to look hard at discrepancies between amounts in their books. They say they've sent $80 million, let's say, to the Clinton Foundation. The Clinton Foundation said, we got $25 million. Well, what happened to the difference? And, you know, for Schneiderman, it's one thing to use discretion. It's another to be grossly incompetent. And this is gross incompetence on his part. It will be seen as such. And more revelations are coming forward shortly that are going to raise the heat for him.
Thanks, Jay, for your question. Brooklyn, Willie, you're on the air.
Yes, my beloved sister. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Thank you for the work you do. I was listening and I said to myself,
we're having some a real problem. Are you on speaker or something, Willie?
Okay, let me cut it. Yeah, how is that? Is that better?
Much better. So what's your question, since we're getting close to time?
Yes. The media is not going to pick this up. Have you, Mr. Ortel, thank you for the work that you're doing. Have you contacted the Final Call? That's a national international paper. And they're not afraid to publish something like this. Thanks a lot.
Sorry, have I contacted who?
The Final Call
is the organ of the Nation of Islam. It's the largest distributed African-American paper or black paper in the United States.
I have not, and I would happily speak to them.
Yes, please do. Thank you for your work.
Oh, thanks. You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
888-874-48. Well, we're kind of running close on time. So, Charles, with this development of the so-called impending shutdown of the Clinton Global Initiative, what do you expect, because this is such an important part of the recruitment process and the sales pitch process and the getting money from foreign governments especially process, what do you expect that function will next show up?
Well, I think, you know, the thing for the Clinton Global Initiative, they made a series of mistakes. And one of the mistakes they made is they put out a searchable database of all their supposed commitments to action. And I'm encouraging, and I'm going to step up the pressure here, academic institutions to study that list carefully. And I mean, you're talking thousands and thousands of supposed commitments to action. When I look at them with a jaundiced eye, many of them, some are just really, it's as if, you know, marijuana were legal now in New York and people had smoked, you know, a forest of marijuana, writing some of them. But, you know, they're just, some are so gigantic as to be absurd. You know, people contributing $1 billion here and $1 billion there. There's no record of that. There's no record anywhere of these gigantic commitments. There's no audit of these commitments that's been shared with the public. There's no way to track and ask whether the pledges that are made at these meetings cannibalize the activities of the underlying charity. In other words, you know, was the charity going to do this anyway? You know, you go to a meeting here in New York, you have a nice meal, guy to your left says, $10 million for such and such, and Woman's Your Rights is $20 million, so you say $30 million. I mean, it's not checked. No one's going to hold you to it. So there's a real exercise, I think, to go through and say, well, of the money that was pledged or, you know, suggested that it might be spent, how much was spent of that, and what were the results? You know, there's a real exercise. They've been doing this since 2005. There's a lot of evidence in the public domain. How much of that was truly charitable? But then how much private gain was created through the operation of these commitments? And I can tell you just off the top of my head, I know of billions of private gain that was created. And you know, if you had a serious team, if you had a Schneiderman and the IRS that were prepared to do the right thing here, and landed on this charity and said, all right, you made all these statements, back them up, you know, and then got through a real process here. Actually, what would come out of this is massive tax revenue for the New York State and for the federal government. There'd be a lot of very unhappy people. But, you know, the tax coffers of our state here in New York and of the federal government and of many foreign governments would be enriched by a lot of money. And in addition, you know, doing the right thing here would send a clear message that no one's above the law, including a former president and an aspiring president-to-be, and that when you screw up in the land of charity, you don't get away. You don't, you know, you don't bubble your way through it and come up with a bunch of smiley aphorism before carefully selected members of the media. You have to own up. And, you know, when you go back through this man's history, and for that matter, his wife's history, there are a lot of fires here, a lot of times where they are either shading the truth or lying under oath, misrepresenting the truth, omitting crucial details. That's not behavior that normally is tolerated anywhere, let alone in charities.
And these are not just ordinary people. There's a former president, for crying out loud, a former U.S. senator, a current presidential candidate. So these are people high up on the food chain politically. The fact that we're not seeing very much traction on the state level doesn't mean that there isn't interest and action pending at the federal level. What do you know?
Well, the rumors and the published accounts, of course, properly, federal investigations and state investigations in this country are supposed to be kept confidential because, you know, they're just that, they're investigations. And the burden in the criminal case is on the government to prove, either by a preponderance of evidence or beyond reasonable doubt, depending on the type of crime, that a crime has, in fact, been committed and that a punishment's warranted. So there's a real process, and the judiciary people generally don't want to compromise that process by sharing prematurely the results of the investigation. That said, powerful media organizations are often, through their contacts, able to discern what may be going on generally, or that something's up. And a number of these news organizations across the political spectrum have been reporting that there are federal investigations in various places being commenced by, I believe, U.S. attorneys, possibly in league with the field offices of the FBI. That's in this country. And in foreign countries, it's quite possible there are companion investigations underway that will rise to a fever pitch should any prosecutions actually get announced or any civil suits commence. So, you know, I think everyone's watching the presidential election, waiting to see how that's going to progress, looking at poll numbers and talking about health rumors and other rumors and issues. But it's a volatile situation right now.
Well, Charles Ortel continues to amass a great deal of information about the Clinton. In fact, he's the recognized expert on the Clinton Foundation. You can go to charlesortel.com. The documents that support every claim that he's making are posted there, and you can definitely look at them at your leisure. Charles, thanks so much for being with us today and putting yet another dimension to this quagmire that we've been trying to just understand. What is this Clinton Foundation, and why is it important to know what it is? Thanks so much for being with us again today.
My pleasure, Yatrice. Thank you.
Thanks. That brings us to the end of our program. Stay tuned. More great programming coming up with Eric Davis's Expanding Mind. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.
No more smoke. Gonna put it out.